Number one question. Understanding gratification, danger and escape. Please elaborate. Also, why do you have to know the gratification? Why not danger and escape? This is actually that some of the things which go on in our mind. For example, thinking. Why do people think? Because it's a gratification, it's a delight in thinking. Why do you get angry? You know, there's a delight in getting angry. And it's really good fun, isn't it? Think of somebody who's really hurt you. Those stupid people, they shouldn't have done that. It makes you feel alive. So getting angry, there's a joy to it. The same as, I don't have to say about the gratification of lust. You all know about that. There's a gratification in sleeping. There's a gratification in eating. So we all know the gratification, but the Buddha said if there wasn't no gratification, say, in anger, people wouldn't get angry. They wouldn't have ill will. They wouldn't have jealousy. They wouldn't have all these negative things because there's a joy in it. So there's a joy in these things. But there's also, the danger in these things. Yeah, it's good fun to get angry and shout at someone because they really need to be told off. And you feel so good afterwards. But then comes the danger when they tell you off back. Or we get into big trouble. So there's dangers in these things. Lust, wow, it's really good fun. Until you have babies. Or until you get into trouble with your missus because you have lust with somebody else. And you know, all these other things, like thinking. You can just sit here and fantasize and dream. It's such a good idea. You don't have any pain. You don't have to worry about your breath. Go and just plan or dream about all sorts of things. But there's a danger, though, afterwards. You get tired. You think, well, I'm wasting my time. And so when you see the danger in these things, you say, yeah, there's a joy there, but the danger. And the danger outweighs the joy. It's like drinking alcohol. You know, people enjoy alcohol, it makes you high. But there's a danger there, and you have to pay it back afterwards. There's a gratification in gambling. You go to the casino, or you go online, and you almost might win. It's a great joy, that's why people go to gambling. But there's a danger there. And so once you understand the danger, you understand just it's not worthwhile. So what's that? A gambling joke. Another gambling joke. I try and tell a joke every evening. And this is about the person who's gone into such deep meditation. Such deep meditation that they could actually contact some spirits. And the spirit said, go to the casino. And they heard it very clearly. Go to the casino. So they went to the casino, and they heard the spirit again, go to the roulette wheel. So they went to the roulette wheel, and he heard the spirit say, put $10 on number 26. And he put $10 on 26, and they spun the wheel, and the ball went into number 26. And he heard the spirit say, yeah, whoopee, put all the winnings on number 17. So he put all the winnings on number 17. They spun the wheel and the ball went into number 17. And he heard the spirit say, fantastic. Put all the winnings on number 6. So he put all the winnings on number 6 and they spun the wheel and it went into number 7. And he heard the spirit say, shit. Because even spirits make mistakes. And that's the danger. So don't, just because the spirit says it, don't believe it's going to work. And that's the danger. So you can see the danger in going to the casino, or danger in gambling. But there's a pleasure there. And if you just say there's a danger, people don't really understand. You're not being honest. They say, but I enjoy going to the casino. I enjoy going shopping. You know the gratification of shopping? You know the danger? You know, when you get the credit card bill at the end of the month. That's the danger. So when you know the gratification, know the danger, being honest. And so you can see, is the danger sort of outweigh the gratification? A lot of time it does. So you say no. And what's the escape from these things? Is actually just seeing, very much just this, the gratification danger, seeing with wisdom what's really going on in life. So you do have a more sense of control over your life, in a good sense, from wisdom. That, you know, you can see all the dangers in life. You don't want to go down that path. And just by noticing it, that's where you get the freedom from. That's the escape. Through the insight, the knowing, what am I doing that for? It doesn't make any sense anymore. And that's, you know, the know all my stories why, as even as a student, I gave up drinking alcohol. And, you know, I'd get drunk sometimes as a student because no one told me anything else. Yeah, it was a pleasure, you know, being with your friends and having a good time. But the danger was the following morning. And I was wise enough to think, what do I do that for? Once I started becoming wise, I thought, what are you drinking alcohol for? It's expensive. It doesn't really do anything for you. It just, you lose all your mindfulness. And, you know, I couldn't remember what happened most of the evening. And so after a while I thought, oh, I'm going to give this up. And you got so many benefits afterwards, health benefits. And also, you know, I always tell that story that when I gave up alcohol at university, I thought I was really sacrificing. I thought I would never get invited to any more parties. They have a word in Australia called a wowser. A wowser is someone who doesn't enjoy the party. You know, so they don't drink, they don't get into all the other silly things which people get into. They're a party pooper. And I thought that no one would invite me to any more parties. But I was invited to even more parties. Why? That's right, because they wanted someone to drive them home. Someone sober, that was me. So actually, being sober, actually got more party invites. Because people trusted you more. So it was a benefit. So when I take like alcohol, you see the danger, you see the benefits, and the dangers were more than the benefits, so I gave it up. Simple as that. Wisdom is the escape. And like thinking. See the dangers of thinking. Where does it get you? It just gives you headaches, and you never get wise. So you see the danger of thinking, you're not interested anymore. So you let it go. And that's the escape. Please explain why we do chanting. It's because you're supposed to be keeping quiet the rest of the day. And so this gives you the opportunity to use your mouth as loud as you like, twice a day. And the rest of the day, shut up. Because otherwise, if you don't use your mouth, you know, after 6 or 7 days, you know, you get stiff and you can't sort of move it so much. So it's that. We do a bit of chanting. And it's also, it does give you some nice teachings, because after you chant these things, you start to learn some of these meanings. Let them be able and upright. Upright, which means not sleeping so much anymore. That's not being upright, that's being horizontal. And you know actually what they say, according to the law of karma, They've got this class of beings, they call the animals, they call it Tirachana Gata. That means like horizontal going beings. Because you notice animals, they go horizontally, we go vertically. And so, if you spend too much time horizontal in your life, you get reborn as a horizontal being. Because that's what you're used to. So we do chant to keep upright, but it's also, they've got some other beautiful words in that Metta Sutta. Let them be contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. Now that's teaching about how to meditate. Be contented, be easily satisfied with your meditation. Not proud and wanting to be the best meditator in the whole retreat. And not demanding in nature. You don't ask for some more things. Just get a little bit of peace. Oh, thank you so much. This is such a great gift. This is good enough for me. And you don't demand anything out of your meditation. You're just so happy. Just have the opportunity to close your eyes and be at peace. Anything else which happens is just extra. If you're demanding in nature, and you've got goals, I have to get nimittas by the end of this retreat, or I'm going to ask for my money back. And I'm not going to be contented. I'm going to ask. It's a great sacrifice coming here, taking time off work, giving a lot of money, spending the money on the aircraft and everything else. I demand value for money. At least jhana. Or I want half my money back. So that's not being content. It's not being easily satisfied. It's being proud, being demanding. That's not metta. That's not kindness. That's not love. That's not peace. You'll never get any meditation depth that way. So when you meditate, you're not demanding anything of yourself. You're not demanding of your mind. You have to be peaceful. You're not demanding your body. You have to be free of pain. You're contented. Thank you so much, body, for just being able to sit for a few minutes. Now if that is your attitude, your meditation takes off. You get very peaceful and very still. When you're not demanding. So the chanting has lots of meaning to it. And that's only a little bit of it. So when you do the chanting, it's another form of brainwashing. So I'm very well, you're chanting again and again and again, and it gets into your head. If I am uncomfortable doing breath meditation, do I need to learn walking meditation? Can I request for a demonstration on how walking meditation is done? Okay. You've all walked before, you've seen other people walking, so you just walk naturally. So you've got the paths in here, in these little rooms, you can go out in the forest, you can, so many places you can do walking meditation. You just usually choose not too long a path, not too short a path, straight, rather than going around in circles. And you start at the beginning of the path. You put your gaze 2 meters in front of you, roughly. You don't need to get a tape measure and tape measure 2 meters. 1.6, 2.4, I don't care. Just so you can see what's in front of you, so you're quite, you feel quite safe. You're not going to walk over a cliff or you're not going to tread on something. And then you just walk, naturally. You all know how to walk. So walk naturally. But as you're walking, present moment awareness, so you're not into the future, not into the past, stop all this thinking business, you're not thinking about the stock market or about the football or about what's happening at home. Instead you're putting all your awareness on the feelings of your feet and legs moving. So you know the left foot is moving, you know the right foot is moving. You know the beginning of the left step. What part of the foot leaves the ground first of all? What part leaves last of all? And once the foot has left the ground, does it go straight up? Go forward a bit? What's its movement through the air? My foot, it goes up and then back a little bit. And then it goes forward. And then it goes down. You feel all the sensations which tells you what your foot is doing. What part meets the ground first? What does it feel like when your feet meets the carpets or meets the wooden floor? What does it feel like, that sensation? Feel it as fully as you possibly can. And what's the last part of your foot which meets the ground? And then you feel the weight of your body transfer onto that foot. So your right foot can lift up. You see all these amazing sensations of just walking. Now you're not forcing it, you're just walking naturally. You are being the passenger, observing all these amazing feelings in your legs as you walk backwards and forwards. And when you get to the end of the path, you stop. And you feel all the sensations of turning around. And the benefits of that is you're focusing on feelings in the body. And the feelings in the body, you can't think about them too much. And you can't get too much of a conversation about the feeling in the foot when it meets the ground. So you can't think so much. It keeps you in the present moment, gives you something to focus on. And after a while, you get very, very still and peaceful. Because those feelings become quite delightful and they absorb your attention. And you walk backwards and forwards, very peaceful, very still. And it has the advantage that you don't have to worry about sitting in a chair or on the floor where you get an aching knee or an aching back. You're moving, so it's very comfortable for your body. And you do that as long as you feel happy. And you get as peaceful and deep as you possibly can. You get very peaceful in walking meditation. And some people prefer it to walk sitting meditation. And that's one of the reasons when we design this hall, we put these three big halls right next to you for walking meditation. And that actually costs more than the main room to put those halls in there. Because it's a much bigger area when you add them all together. So we did that because it was necessary to encourage also walking meditation as well as sitting meditation. So experiment with this walking meditation. And sometimes when you get peaceful in the walking meditation, you find it enhances your sitting meditation. Your sitting meditation gets much deeper. So make use of it. It's very simple instructions. So nothing in this meditation is complicated. Dear Bhante, please explain sublime abiding. That's in an hour or two when you go to sleep. Oh, this is nice. No, that's not the sublime abidings. The sublime abidings usually means the four Brahma-viharas of metta, karuna, mudita, upeka. The metta is just the loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. The karuna is may all suffering beings be free of suffering. And the mudita is rejoicing with the beings who are happy. The meditator next to you has just become enlightened. Oh, I'm so glad for you that you're enlightened. It's the opposite of saying, it's really unfair. It's the first meditation retreat they've been to. I've been to 20 and I'm not enlightened yet. And they've got it first time. This is really unfair. That sucks. Now that is not mudita. So mudita is this beautiful like joy, selfless joy in other people's happiness. And upeka is this beautiful equanimity, this stillness, just looking on with peace, with deep peace. Now they call for sublime abidings when they are the cause for your deep meditations. So the metta is a beautiful way of meditating. May all beings be happy and well. And you feel the sensations afterwards until metta gets very strong. Or if you wanted to, you can do metta with your breath. May my in-breath be happy and well. Look, I really care for you in-breath. Just go in with my blessing, peaceful, and out-breath. Just have a great time as you go out. May all my out-breaths be happy and well. May all my in-breaths be free of pain. When you do that little metta towards your breath, your breath becomes so soft and gentle and beautiful and peaceful. And it's very easy to meditate. So you can apply these things. I find it difficult to do karuna because when you're focusing on suffering and pain, that's what most of you do most of the time. So just leave that behind at this meditation retreat. Mudita is good, upeka is good. But the one which I don't recommend is karuna because it really brings you down when you focus on the suffering of life. You do that most of the time. Focus on the positive side instead. And that gives you this beautiful, sublime abiding of peace, of metta, of mudita. Make sense? Well, that's the sublime abidings. Per Ajahn Brahm, please give your mega metta to the dishwasher. It stopped working at lunchtime today. You lazy people. Why do you need a dishwasher to work? You got your two hands. You got this little mop. You can wash up the dishes yourself. So that's a trouble these days. People get so lazy that they get these electronic things. Just press a button. Wouldn't it be really wonderful that sometimes actually some of the monks, we saw these visual, what's it called? Not visual reality. When they put these goggles on you, and virtual reality, yeah. They're asking me whether I can get virtual reality Nimitta machines. They put them on here. These beautiful lights come into your mind. It makes meditation much easier. Of course you can't do things like that. So that doesn't matter. It's wonderful that sometimes things go wrong, which means that you can wash the things up by hand, which means you can make more good karma. Now, this is a very deep teaching, because when you make good karma by washing dishes and you think, even though it's not my job today, but I really want to help others, and you just volunteer, it's amazing how much joy you get. One of the key experiences as a young monk in Thailand, there was three monks were about to ordain. I'd already ordained as a monk. And in northeast Thailand, if you were going to ordain as a monk, you had to make your own set of three robes, starting with white cloth and sewing them first of all, which took about 2 or 3 days. And then you'd have to dye them with jackfruit dye, which means hauling water from the well, getting the wood to start a fire, getting these branches of the jackfruit tree, chopping them up into little chips, and boiling those chips to extract the dye, and then concentrating the dye and using that on the white cloth to create the brown colour. It was very hard work, took many days. And this group of monks were making their set of three robes. And they hadn't slept for about, 48 hours? Because they had to, when you're making the dye, you couldn't leave it. You had to keep on that fire, keep working. And because they had this, maybe not 48 hours, maybe 36 hours. And after the evening chanting, I went to the dyeing shed, and the poor monks were very tired. And I said, look, you go and take a few hours sleep. I'll go without my sleep tonight to look after your dyeing. But don't tell anybody, because you know, it's a bit of cheating, breaking the rules. But out of compassion for these three monks. So they went off to bed, and I looked after the dye pot for them all night. And 3 o'clock in the morning, the bell went to get up. And so they came out and carried on doing the dyeing, and I went to the morning chanting. And the morning meditation. And you know, I was bright and clear, I had no sleepiness at all. I was full of energy. I remember asking the senior monk when we went on arms round. I said, this is really strange. I haven't slept all night. And I've got all this wonderful energy. I'm not at all tired. Not the slightest trace of sloth and torpor. Why? And he said, because you've made good karma. Because you've helped others. You sacrifice your sleep for others. And the result is you get special energy. And I've used that throughout my whole monastic life. Any opportunity I have for doing good karma, even though I don't need to, even though I'm an abba, I'm supposed to be senior monk, if I can do it before you do it, I'll do it. Why? Because I know just how much energy and joy you get out of it. So when you understand that, it's not a case of whose turn is it to wash the dishes. Get out of the way, I'm going to do it. And it's much more fun that way, because then you want to give, you want to do things, you want to help. You get lots of energy that way. So it's a great blessing that the dishwasher has actually broken, which gives you more opportunity to make merit, good karma. Brilliant, well done. Dear Ajahn, is there a difference between being kind and being compassionate? Thank you. I think what they really mean there is that being like kind without wisdom. Because compassionate is usually means you have wisdom as well. But many people are kind without wisdom, and they end up making a big mess in life. And you know what happens when you say you're kind to somebody? I always say that it's the... When I used to be in the Boy Scouts, You always had to do a good job, a good deed for the day. That was your motto, do a good deed for the day. So you see all these Boy Scouts used to help old ladies cross the road in the busy traffic. The only trouble was the old lady never wanted to go in the first place. That's being kind, but not being wise. So being compassionate is realizing sometimes that compassion is much bigger than kindness. Sometimes, you have to hiss, you have to be strong, and sometimes you have to upset somebody. You're being compassionate to them. It doesn't look like you're being kind to them, but you're being compassionate. And it's also the compassion goes to yourself as well. Even. So yeah, there is compassion and kindness have to be with wisdom, and compassion is bigger. Kind sometimes is not the right thing. Maybe. Anyway. What is the best way to thank you for the teachings that you have given to us through your talks? Though I can't meditate well and usually fall asleep, can't be very good talks I'm giving then. These Dharma teachings are most certainly interesting, have changed my perspective of life. Thank you so much. The best way you can thank a teacher is what? The best way to thank a teacher is to make the teacher happy. And how does a teacher become happy? When I see you getting into some nice meditation, when I see your life becoming very peaceful and happy, and you're able to help others and your life is going smoothly, that makes me happy. And when you get into these deep meditations and you really get sort of some bliss, I'm being honest, that's what really makes me happy. That's what I get off on as a teacher. When you come up and say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, it was so nice. That's what I love teaching. It may not happen this retreat, but one retreat it happens. And to me, that's the payback. To see you blissed out and happy. That's what I do all this for. So you thank, this is what the Buddha said, you show gratitude to a Buddha by not by offering flowers and candles and incense and chanting. That's not how you pay respect to a Buddha. He said you pay respect to the Buddha by following the Buddha's teachings. And by achieving those goals of peace and happiness. Just like your parents. How do you say thank you to your parents for all they've done for you? By being a happy, good son or daughter. That's all parents want of their children. To be good, happy, settled in their life. That's the greatest gift you can give back to your parents. This morning, Dharma talk, you mentioned about accumulated energy in an established meditation center. What is this energy and how can one sense it? It's amazing just how many people there can be pretty insensitive in most of their life, but they go into some of these places and it really sort of gets to them. And I was telling somebody in the interviews that there's one of the people who help out at our city centre. Her job with her husband is to count the donations every week and to bank them for us. And she used to be a Christian before. And her husband was very interested in Buddhism. And after a while, she sort of followed her husband and became a very devout Buddhist. But her husband wanted to go on one of these pilgrimages to India, the Buddhist holy sites. And so she tagged along. And I gave them this orientation class before we left. And I mentioned that some of these places we go to in India have got very powerful energy. And she thought I was being crazy, a stupid monk. Because she was born in England and she'd been to all these old castles and palaces where kings and queens lived. And now what do you mean? It's just old stones, that's all. Just old buildings, it's history, that's all. Nothing more than that. But the very first place she went into was the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya. And afterwards she came to say, ask forgiveness of me. Because as soon as she walked in, totally unexpected, she started weeping, not crying, just weeping and weeping. She couldn't stop herself. Because it touched her in such a deep place. These have got energy, these places. This is where the Buddha was enlightened. Sometimes it just gets you unexpectedly. And you go to these places and you think, oh, it's just a place where the Buddha became enlightened. So what? Ooh. That's really got power. You just can't stop yourself. And I've told many people, when I go to the Vulture's Peak up there, that's where the Buddha spent a lot of time. And that gets me every time. I just start crying. Just get incredible energy, this beauty, this happiness. And just, you can't stop yourself. It's just the energy there. Because that's where the Buddha became enlightened. That's where you meditate a lot. That's got huge energy and power. But also, I tell the story that on one of those pilgrimages to India, we went, I think we landed at Kathmandu. This was before the airport at Gaya was built. So we started at Kathmandu. And so because you had a lot of other people, we went on this tour of Kathmandu, the city there. And as I was bored, you know, they were just palaces, historical and architectural interesting things, but nothing really which fascinated me. So we're going past this palace, and I was getting bored. So I wasn't following the tour guide. You know, I was just being rebellious and just having a look around myself. And I went through this doorway into this courtyard. And my goodness, the energy there was just so bad. You know, just so negative, so black. And you know, it was so bad, I just left it pretty quickly. And I asked the tour guide, what was that? He said, oh, that's the place where every year the king slaughters the animals for the annual Hindu festival. And I just wandered in there, and I didn't know what place it was. But you know, if you imagine, all these animals, these goats and sheep, I don't know what else, are ritually killed once a year. That place is black. It's a terrible place. You just want to get out straight away. And that's what I mean about places have energy. You can feel them. And just ordinary people, let alone a monk, you can really feel these places. So that's why that in these places we build up this really, really nice energy. As I just said, this place, its energy is just building up. Over the other places, it's got huge energy. Would you please give walking meditation a short introduction? What kind of pace? Just natural pace. Usually what happens when you do walking meditation, when you start to get peaceful and still, you do naturally go slow. But don't try to go slow. I've seen in these rooms here, sometimes there's a competition to who can go slowest. Someone next to you is going slow, damn it, I better go slow, same as them. Keep it natural, don't look at anybody else. Woo, this is a long one, okay. If at all possible, can you just keep questions short, because this is a long one, but nevertheless. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for the Q&A session, which helped clarify many doubts. This is one part of the sutra I don't understand. There are detailed descriptions of different planes of existence, including different heavenly planes, to the hell realm. The Indra world, there are fights within and between Deva planes. There is Sakadeva with huge merits and hundreds of wives. In hell, there are hell wardens, physical tortures. There are people reading out the person's wrongdoing before the punishments, blah, blah, blah. All these were myth to me, but it seems real and literal in the suttas. Although these are not critical to the spiritual path, but it does cast some doubt. Is it that our current mind cannot understand what is beyond us, that it becomes mythical, or are these to be taken as symbolic meaning or literal? When someone exhausts their karma in hell and got the chance to be human again, would they retain the learning and steer clear from the past wrongdoings? If Deva realms are planes of enjoyment, why are there fights? What about the Devas who need to be wives of the same Deva? Is this really planes of pleasure for the Devis? Hope this is not too shallow a question. Thank you for your patience. It's not too shallow a question. So thank you for asking that, because you know, that was something which bothered me as like a rationalist Buddhist, you know, one who believes in science. What were these different realms? I can understand the high heavenly realms. That made a lot of sense to me. But some of these lower realms. And two, you really got into your meditation and realize just, you know, the power of the mind. When you start getting into nimitta realms, you know, the body starts to disappear and you get these mental images. Just the range of mental images is huge. And what's actually happening, you've got something real there, but you're adding so much with your perception. So the colors which you see in nimittas, or the shapes, or what you actually see, you realize just how much of this world you create with the mind. And I realized from that, the hell realms are created by you. You know, if you have done some bad karma, and you need to go to a hell realm, it's only because you think you deserve to go there. That's all. No one sends you down there. You send yourself down there. No one reads out your past misdeeds. You remember them, and that's what it feels like. That's how you perceive it. And you stay down there as long as you feel you need to. It's called guilt. And it's wonderful to understand just the power of guilt and its release through forgiveness, through letting go of the past. Even in this life, many of you have done bad things, and because of that, you feel so guilty, you actually punish yourself in this life. And if you remember at the end of your life, you'll punish yourself again. You may send yourself down to a hell realm. And all you need to do is just to let that past go. You don't need to feel guilty. You can forgive. And this is what one learns in meditation. How do you learn to forgive? To loosen this identification of me, the self, with all of these past deeds. To let go of me. Because they say, and it's true, you can understand how it works, when you do see non-self, you do become a stream winner, the first stage of sainthood. The lower realms are no longer possible for you. You cannot get reborn in hell or in the animal realms, no matter what you've done. Why? Because once you became a stream winner, once you've seen the nature of what you took to be yourself, forgiveness becomes so easy. We know there's no self in there, it's easy to forgive. It's easy to let go. So, becoming a stream winner is the best way to make sure you never go to the hell realms again. To be able to let go and forgive all that past which you may have done or others have done to you. It gives you so much freedom when you realize you don't have to feel bad about that. You can let it go. As you go to the heaven realms, it said, you make the heaven realms to suit you. Which I remember now, Helen's from Norway, we've got two Norwegian monks in our monastery, and they told me about what's called Valhalla. Valhalla, or Val's Hall, was where good Vikings would go. It's their heaven realm. And in Valhalla, the heaven realm for the Vikings, as soon as, you only go there if you die in battle, you know, being a good Viking. And there's this big hall with this big feast and lots of alcohol. And you eat and you drink and then you have a fight. And all the people in the hall kill each other. And then after you've killed each other, you wake up again in this great hall with more food, more drink and more fighting. Because that's the thing which the Vikings like most of all. The three things. Food, drinking, and fighting. And that was the heaven realm. No girls. They're really blokey stuff. And if that's what you really like, that's what you think is heaven, that's what you get. So you got people from Singapore, what would be a Singapore heaven for you? And you actually create it. You know, the best coffee shop, restaurants which are open 24 hours, and you never feel full. So you keep on eating. And in the heaven realm for the Singaporeans, the stock market always goes up, never goes down. And don't, you make that heaven realm, you make it. So those realms where the heavenly beings fight is because they enjoy fighting. It's just mind-made, it's not real, it's fantasy, it's like virtual reality. And in those realms they always win. If Wayne Rooney died, and if he made lots of merit by becoming a Buddhist, and giving lots of money to the Buddhist Fellowship, then when he died, he'd go to this heaven realm of this football team, which always won, every game would win. Because he'd make it that way, that's what the mind does. It makes the realm, the heaven realm, to suit yourself. The mind does that. Because these are all mind-made realms. So that's why, in some of those realms, if that's what you get off on, you know, having 100 wives, you have to be stupid. One wife, as many of you know, is more than enough suffering. So when I saw this saga has, you know, thousands of wives, I think that guy's stupid, absolutely stupid. So these aren't real wives, they're just created by the person. You create heaven to suit you. So, understanding how all these things are mind-made realms, you make them, you create them. So you can create whatever heaven you want. So those particular heavens the Buddha described, those were the most common ones in those days. And even those realms which you see, there's other realms which is other mentioned in other parts of the suttas, such as the kidda devas. These are the devas who love playing, who just mess around all the time, tell jokes and play practical tricks on each other, because that's what they get lots of fun out of. So people are like that. That's the heaven realm they make. So whatever heaven realm you like, that's the one you'll go to. You'll make it, because you think you deserve it, and you stay there as long as you think that you deserve it. And when you think, no, you've had enough, then you come back to be reborn again. If you have guilt, then you have to feel you have to pay off something. You think you deserve to be punished, therefore you create a hell realm for yourself. You create them. So the things you see in the temple drawings, that's just, you know, how people would create things in those days. These days, you know, we have totally different ideas of hell. For me, because I remember being in Penang last Christmas, and in the room I was staying in, I was teaching a retreat, and the evening question and answers, you know, finished about 10:30. I went to have a rest, and it was actually Christmas Day. And just opposite the road, they were having a party. I don't mind parties, but it was a karaoke party. Now that is suffering. For me, hell would be a karaoke bar, which never stopped. Because these people, they get drunk and they think they can sing and they can't, and it's disgusting. So this is what we create. Anyway, next question. So it's a good question, that. A kind request to everyone who carries a watch or a clock in the meditation hall that makes a sound, tick, 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 every second or beeps every hour, to leave it in their room. Why do they need to know what time it is during meditation anyway? The time is now, of course. Okay, so try and please, you know, your tick, 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 clock. But sometimes people get very sensitive. So you don't need to beep. And again, you can put it on silent mode or something or other. And there's a clock outside if you want to check it. And I tell you, look, the most important times of the day, breakfast and lunch, you have biological clocks called craving. And you'll always know it's around sort of 6:45 or 11 o'clock. So you don't really need a clock. So if it's noisy, try and sort of put it away. Try and be quiet. Is there any age limit to become a monk? No, we're very desperate to get more monks, so... as long as you're still breathing. If you're too old, it's too possible. What are the age requirements? But no, practically, that if a person is very old, it depends upon their health. Now, if they're a monk or a nun, because when you get sick, we have to look after you. And so if you get too many old monks, all the young monks spend all the time as like nurses. And they've got no time to do anything else. So that's why you do need, you know, a large number of young monks or young nuns to look after a sick nun. Just one or two is not really enough. So usually if someone's very old, we just, you know, check their health first of all, make sure that in many, many years they're still going to be really fit and healthy enough to look after themselves. Okay, next question. Okay, this is the same question. What was the question when the answer is found? So whoever wrote that drank too much coffee. What was the question when the answer is found? So when the answer is found, there's not a question anymore, so the question has disappeared. There's only time when there's a question, when the answer hasn't been found. When the answer is found, it's no longer a question. Does that make sense? Maybe it's too late for this sort of stuff. What is the benefits and purposes of doing walking meditation other than it being a physical exercise? It does actually create deep sense of stillness and happiness and insights. The other way of doing walking meditation, you might as well introduce it now, is a very wonderful way. It's fun and it gives you great insight. It's using a mantra. This was actually part of what I heard in Thailand years ago, but it translates well into English. When you're walking on the paths, as your left foot moves forward, you think to yourself the mantra, I will die. As the other foot moves forward, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And in Thai it was like, die, neh, die, neh, I will die, that's for sure. Now when people start that, they think it's a joke. But after a while, you realize, this is not a joke. This is one thing which is so true, you can't deny it. I will die, that's for sure. Then you come across fear. My God, it's true. I will die, that's for sure. Keep on walking, keep on chanting, I will die, that's for sure. You get through the fear. And because, you know, I will die, that's for sure. All your attachments, all your worries, all the worries about your emails, stock markets, your business, your husband, your kids, even your health, all of it just vanishes. I will die, that's for sure. What am I worrying about all this for? You get really peaceful. You get some very deep insights in how to be free. I will die, that's for sure. What a relief. So try that one, it's good fun. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Okay, working with it. How is the meditation method that we are practicing different from Vipassana? Okay, this is the Vipassana and Samatha. Some people say this is Samatha because you're getting peaceful. Other people say it's Vipassana. And the old story is, once upon a time, there was this happy married couple. The husband was called Sam. Sam Atta. And his wife was Vi. Vipassana. And Sam and Vi, after dinner one afternoon, decided to go for a walk up the mountain, up Meditation Mountain. And they decided to take their dog with them. And the dog was called Metta. So Sam, Vi and Metta the dog went up the walk to the mountain. Now Sam, he wanted to go up the mountain because it was so peaceful up there. It was so still on top of the mountain. His wife, Vi, she wanted to go up there for the view. She took her camera to take this incredible view which you see at the top of Meditation Mountain. And Metta the dog just went up there for the fun of things. Because dogs are very simple. They're not complicated like us. They just enjoy going for a walk up the mountain. So there was the three of them going up the mountain. The higher they got, the more still it became. So Sam was enjoying the stillness. Even halfway up, it was so peaceful. Even halfway up, Fi could see such a long distance. He could see so much. He was taking photographs. Insight camera, it was called. And the higher they got, the more that Metta the dog wagged her tail. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, wow, the stillness was so profound. Sam just enjoyed the stillness so much, because that's what he went up there for. But Sam had a pair of eyes, so he also saw the magnificent view on top of Meditation Mountain. As for Vi, she went up there for the view, and the view was out of this world. But she could also feel the stillness. And so she delighted in the stillness on top of Meditation Mountain. And as for little Metta the dog, wow, she was running around in circles, wagging her tail like it's going to go off. Because on top of Meditation Mountain, there is stillness. There's insight. And is bliss. The three of them coexist. So, what you're doing here is Vipassana. It is samatha. It is bliss. Because the three of them coexist on the top of Meditation Mountain. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have these good meditations where the breath is just being breath and everything is just quiet. Then I wonder, where is the mind? I cannot feel the mind. Or is it that silence that is the mind? Many thanks. You stupid, you started thinking. But you're getting nice and peaceful. I had this meditation where the breath is just being the breath and everything is just quiet. Don't disturb the quiet. It's really strange that people, they get to very quiet meditations and then try and disturb. Remember that seminar I said, I think this morning, about when I walked up that hill in Nepal, and just when I got to the top, I saw the Himalaya mountains, and I ran down to get my camera, and when I ran up again, the clouds had closed and I couldn't see the Himalayas anymore. That's what happens here. You're being peaceful. Don't disturb it. Enjoy it. So don't start thinking, where is the mind? You know that I was trained as a scientist. When I do an experiment, I don't figure out the meaning of the experiment, work out the results, until all the data has been collected. If you try and make a conclusion when you've only got half the data, that will skew all of your results. So don't think where the mind is or what's happening until the very end of the meditation, when all the experience is in. And then you can start thinking, what was that? What was happening? What was going on? In the middle of the meditation, just be quiet. Be still. Allow yourself to collect more data. So don't try and figure it out in the middle of the journey. Wait till the end. Do lay Buddhists have to go propagate the Dharma? I'm asking, as nowadays Christianity is very in the East and still growing, so is Buddhism. Christianity is moving to the East and Buddhism is moving to the West. It's true. In Dhammaloka, in our Nolamara Center, if you go there, that hall, there used to be a Christian church. So we took it over. So they say they're selling all their churches in the West and they're buying the churches in Singapore and other places. But don't worry. We've got them covered. And it's true because, you know, we sort of talk to many, many people. But you know that when it gets to conversions, you have to go to the top. So, you know, I'm trying to... Actually, somebody said this on the weekend. I was telling my monks in Serpentine, just in the monastery over the road. They told me there's a lady in Sri Lanka had very bad cancer. And she did some meditation or chanting and remembered me, and her cancer got cured. It was a miracle. And apparently last weekend, it was big news in Australia because the very first Australian saint was made a saint in the Vatican because she needed two miracles. Now I've got one, I just need another one. That I can be a saint. And when I go to the Vatican, then he can convert the Pope. And that's actually how we take over well, why not? He's a reasonable man. So once we converted that, so we just forget about all these little pastors in the little churches. Just we go to the top and convert the bottom. Actually, I've got to be careful because these talks are recorded. They go on the internet. This is just a joke, okay? Anyway, no, because propagating the Dharma, again, I mean, it's one of the reasons is because, like with Buddhism, it's so rational, it's down to earth, it's evidence based, and I think a lot of time we just need to understand our Buddhism, know it, and tell it to people. And when you tell it to people, it makes so much sense. You get a lot of people becoming Buddhists. And, you know, most of the Western world, especially Europe, has turned away from Christianity. Because basically it's against science. It doesn't make sense according to all the evidence which has come from science. Whether it's the origin of the world, you know, Stephen Hawking recently went on record saying he doesn't believe in God. They're not the creator God. Buddhas have never believed in a creator God from the very beginning. And some of the other stuff that many of the Christians don't believe in, climate change, global warming, they say, well, why do you need to? Because God will sort it out. And that's just dangerous, because it means that people aren't really caring, aren't being proactive. They just let it happen and think somebody else is going to sort out the problem. So many people, when they see what's going on, they get us either turn away from religion totally, like many people are in the West, and if they haven't done it yet, they'll be turning away from religion in Singapore. Basically because it doesn't fit with what they learn in schools and universities. But Buddhism does. So we are very well positioned, but we just need to go out and just tell, you know, the Dhamma, teach the Dhamma. And there aren't enough monks and nuns, so we do need everybody's help. First of all, learn these teachings. And they just make so much sense. And the other stuff just basically doesn't make any sense at all. So Buddhism is also very in the West. And very often the East ends up imitating the West, but maybe 10 or 15 years behind. It's not easy being a monk. What do you mean it's not easy being a monk? I think it's the other. It's not easy being a lay person. I mean, look what you have to do. Monday morning you have to go to work, and you never get enough pay, and you're always worried whether you're doing the right work, and then you get married, and you know, it's fun at first, but then you have to pay for it for the rest of your life. And you have kids, and they wake you up in the middle of the night, and they give you all sorts of worries and troubles. They never turn out exactly what you want them to. And it gives you so many worries, and then you sort of get old, you have to worry about who's going to look after you later on when you die, where you're going to get reborn. Oh, it's so hard. I don't know how you manage it, you people. But being a monk, you're free. No worries, no concerns, no worries about your job. I have job security. The economies go up, go down, I've always got a job. I've always got not something to eat. And you don't have all these worries which other people have. So when you really think about it, it is a wonderful lifestyle. Talk about propagating the Dhamma. The BF in Singapore, they should have a stall in all the universities in Singapore recruiting monks and nuns with career options. Be wonderful, why not? Because they have all these other career stores, you know, for Hewlett-Packard and the National Army in Singapore or Delawitt, whatever it's called, all those other places, those other big companies. But yeah, have a store there. Career as a monk or a nun. Why not? Anyway, it's very easy. Anyway, what is it? Have you ever thought about quitting halfway? Oh, no. The first half is the hardest. The next half is the easy one. You don't quit halfway. How did Ajahn learn to do building and plumbing, etc.? Because you had to. And because, no. All of plumbing, all of building is just common sense. In other words, you know, you just use your intelligence, be mindful, focus, you can do anything you want. So you can plumb, you can build, you can do all sorts of stuff. Do you know that half of the floor which you're sitting on was laid by monks? The monks laid that. They gave up their time of meditating so they could finish this hall and lay this beautiful bamboo floor for you. And they don't get any benefit out of it. They did it as dharma for you. Very inspiring. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can we lay people be enlightened in this lifetime? If so, how do we do it? Yes, you can. This is how you do it. Come to meditation retreats. This is my first meditation retreat. I've never been educated in walking meditation. Any advice? Yes. Left foot first, then right foot. And keep on going. Do all stupas contain Buddhist relics, including the two outside the meditation hall? Now, those stupas contain little Buddhas inside. And they come from Borobudur in Java. They're from the Java stone. They're just to make it auspicious. They are 108% the size of the original, slightly bigger by the fact of 108%. Isn't that auspicious number? And according to the legend, that if you can climb onto that stupa and put your hand through one of those holes, and if you can touch the Buddha inside, then according to the ancient legend, you will find true love. That's what they say. So you see all these people, in Muslims, Buddhists, Christians in Java, climbing this stupa and reaching and stretching themselves till it hurts to try and touch this. And if I find any of you doing that, especially if you're already married, I'm going to tell your wife. Finding true love. So they don't all contain relics. Paying respect to stupa, slightly paying respect to triple... Is it... Paying respect to stupa signifies paying respect to triple gem. What is the real significance of continuous ceremony? When you pay respects to anything, you don't pay respects to a stupa, you don't pay respects to a monk, you don't even pay respects to a Buddha statue, you pay respects to what it represents. So when I bow to a Buddha statue, first of all I bow to virtue. Because I respect virtue, goodness, keeping precepts. And that leads to happiness. Number two, I bow to stillness, to peace. That's just so beautiful. And lastly, I bow to compassion. I bow to virtue, peace and compassion. And that's what I respect. So the stupa, the triple gem, the Buddha, is what it signifies. When I remember why I'm bowing, it means that factors like virtue, peace and compassion grow in me. Because I remember it, and I'm bowing, which means that these are the things I really value in life. That is a symbol of virtue, peace and compassion. But I don't bow to the Buddha, I bow to what that statue represents. Virtue, peace and compassion. Well, that's so nice. I love bowing to virtue, peace and compassion, because I really worship those qualities. Sometimes after meditation I felt I have wasted my time. Well done. You're getting somewhere. Because why are you trying to achieve something? Why are you thinking that time has to be used and get something out of it at the end? Well, isn't life a waste of time? You know, 50, 60, 70 years, you just die anyway. After a couple of generations, no one remembers you. Yeah, maybe the first generation they'd go and look after your grave. Second generation, you'd be lucky. Third generation, no, you're all gone. They'll probably build a big condominium over your grave. So what a waste of a time. So life is a waste of time. Except if you're doing something useful like meditating. I could not sustain the present moment. Awareness thoughts always came in between the breaths. What if this continues? I'm all the same after 3 years or even more. Brilliant. Well done. All these people who try and attain something. That's just egotistical, stupid people. It won't happen that way. People always worry, oh, what will it happen if for 3 years and I still haven't got anything in the meditation? 4 years, 10 years, 100 years. It doesn't work that way. So have a bit of confidence that if you keep following the instructions, it's going to work. Just like when you turn on the computer. Do you think, oh, what would happen if it never turns on? What happens if it's always going to crash? You just follow the instructions and it works. And this is a much better program than any sort of stuff coming out of Microsoft. This comes from actually Buddhasoft. This is really good stuff, and so it works. So just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Like on the backs of people's t-shirts. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's all you need to do. Your mind is restless. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And that's something you can always achieve Maybe sometimes you can't make the mind still, you can't let go of the thoughts. Sometimes you can't sort of get rid of the sloth and torpor. You can always make peace with it. You can always be kind. You can always be gentle. And that's within your power, no matter what's happening. And that's all you need to do. And then peace comes, and the joy of kindness, and the beautiful equanimity of gentleness is with you. What is the fuel for discontent? What is the fuel for contentment? The fuel for discontent is thinking happiness lies somewhere else. The enlightenment is somewhere different from where you already are now. That's why you say discontent or suffering is the distance between where you want to be and where you are. Where do you want to be? Is that where you are? If it's not, that's called discontent. How do you solve the problem? Trying to strive and struggle to get where you want to be? Or changing your idea of where you want to be and making it where you are? So I don't want to be anywhere. I just want to be right here, in this seat, with my stupid mind, restless, dull, all over the place. I just want to be here. Then there's no discontent. You can be content with sloth and torpor. You can even be content with restlessness. And if you are content, fully content, you'd be totally surprised. All your restlessness and sloth and torpor just vanish. So you can always be where you are. That's what we call making peace again. So wherever you are in this retreat, be here. Don't try and be somewhere else. That's being dishonest to your reality. Just be here. And then all your craving, all your wanting, all your striving, all the stuff which keeps agitating the mind, disappears. So if you want to be here, you really want to be here, and you are not proud and demanding in nature, you're contented and easily satisfied. I'm satisfied by being dull. I'm satisfied being restless. When you make peace with that, because you're making peace, you're letting go of craving. You're following the path of a Buddha. And soon you become enlightened. Stop wanting. Stop creating this distance, this separation from where you are and where you want to be. Is it okay to meditating wearing noise-cancelling headphones or earplugs? I live on a somewhat noisy street. Can't see why not. So you can wear these big earphones. But as not just noise-cancelling, you can have sort of get a little iPod on there which says the words to you in your left ear. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Make it interesting. Yeah, you can use those. How can I stop the mind from planning into the future? Should I allow it to carry on? How do I bring it back to present moment? Just reflect. All the things which you think is going to happen, they never do. The Buddha said, whatever you think it's going to be, it'll be something different. That's the future. The future is what you never expected to happen. Did you really think one day you'd be here in Australia, you know, in this retreat center, you know, spending an evening in front of a monk? Did you really think this would ever happen? You know, maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and here you are. That's what the future is. It's totally unexpected. So I couldn't predict this. When I know just the future is totally unpredictable, it's a waste of time planning for it. Because I just don't know. That's why I was telling people, just expanding my repertoire to politics. I say politicians should never be elected on their promises for what they're going to do in the future. Because no one knows the future. And that's why I never blame a politician for breaking such promises. Because, you know, they have to adapt to changing circumstances. Another war comes, a terrorist attack, the stock market does this and goes left, right, who knows. So no one could predict the credit crunch. Well, all these economists, we pay them a heck of a lot of money, and they couldn't even predict it. They should all get the sack. It'd be like all these economists who couldn't predict the credit crunch. I compared it to like these people who work for the weather forecast who can't predict sort of, you know, a hurricane coming. Just what's their purpose in life if they can't tell us what the weather's going to be? And of course they can't, it's because it's so uncertain, unpredictable. So why do we bother about thinking about it when we just don't know what's going to happen? It's a total waste of time. And as for politicians, we know they can't predict the future, so we should elect them on their past behaviour, not their future promises. And the ability to adapt, the proven ability to adapt to the unforeseen circumstances of your future. So, that's how you stop planning the future, because it's so totally uncertain. How can I allow it to carry on, or should I do it, bring about the first one? Just use wisdom. It's a total waste of time. For breathing, walking, meditation, is it best to slow the breath, walk, or will the effect be better? No, just be natural. It's not a race to see who breathes in fastest or longest. Just enjoy and make it happen as it nature wants it to. In regard to walking meditation, where I walk slowly in the cold bamboo floor barefoot, I can feel the sensation of my feet better than on a mat. Your content, Sajjan Bhavan, yeah, you can do that if you want. But if you really want to feel the sensations fully, walk on broken glass, like a bit of barbed wire. Then you can really feel the sensation. You're very mindful then. No, whatever. You can still feel the sensations on the carpet. If you really are dull, walk on the cold stuff. If you're really dull, on broken glass. Should a monk teach other than Dharma and meditation such as healing? Is it against the Vinaya rule for a monk to teach healing and Qigong full time? And yes and no. They say that if a person is staying in your monastery and the monk knows how to sort of heal them, then yes, if they're resident there. If they're visiting a monastery, they can give advice, but they can't do more than that. If they're not visiting a monastery, it's not the monk's business. And also, look, now sometimes monks feel they can do cures, and they can sprinkle some holy water and magic, everything's gone, but sometimes it doesn't work. And we could be in big trouble if you sue us afterwards. You come here for a cancer, I give you holy water, and you die after my holy water. I do some chanting for you, and then you... It doesn't work, you can sue me. So this is not the main job of a monk to do healing. The main job of a monk is to teach the Dhamma. And also to practice the Dhamma. You know that in Malaysia, Sven Agacitta, a very nice monk, he was starting years ago this monastery as a training center for monks. And being like a modern Western educated monk in Malaysian Chinese, he made the wonderful suggestion, let's do a survey of our customer base, you guys. That's amongst customer base in our lay community. Let's see what they want in their monk. It's just doing like a market survey, like in other businesses. So what do people want out of a monk? And he gave them this list, this tick box. Now, do you want a monk to be a good teacher? Do you want a monk to, sort of say, teach your kids in Dharma school? Do you want them to be an author? Do you want them to be an administrator? Do you want them to be, sort of, a lecturer? Or do you want them to be a professor? Do you want them to be an author? Do you want them to be a meditator? Do you want them to keep their precepts? Do you want them to be able to give advice with counseling? Do you want them to do healing? Do you want them to, or give some other suggestions? And he sent this out to heaps and heaps of the Buddhist communities, and he collated all the results. And of all the things I've told you, you know what people were scored way above everything else, what people wanted out of their Sangha, was to keep the precepts. More than anything else, not being a teacher, not being a good meditator, not being a counselor or an author, the thing they really, really wanted was their Sangha, for them to be proud of them. They kept their precepts. And I was so overjoyed when I heard that. First of all, monks, nuns, that's what people want from you. Please keep your precepts. If you can teach, if you can counsel, if you can be an author, that's wonderful too. But first and foremost, be someone whose virtue is so good that we can be proud that we're Buddhists being led by you. That was very profound and a great idea. Just asking people, what do you want from monks and nuns? And healing. I mean, doctors do a much better job than we do. And lastly, can a monk work? My goodness, we can. But not for money. We just do it for fun. Aha! I love this question. My goodness. If I have lots of condensed milk in my tea, 6 or more teaspoons, I think I only have 4, don't I? I don't know, I never put it in myself. Would it improve my meditation practice? And the answer is, well, it works for me. I don't know, don't be too hard on yourself. So give yourself a bit of fun. So don't be too ascetic. And that way that you can have some sort of, you know, a bit of peace and happiness and get some nice food. And then sort of you don't have to worry too much about hunger. And then that way you can be nice and peaceful and happy. That was a joke question, but I'll keep this one and find out from the handwriting who it was. No, I think it was one of you funny guys. Okay, so thank you for those questions this evening. I hope you enjoyed this evening's entertainment. Sorry? Yes. Sadhu. 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 That wasn't good enough. Try again. Sadhu. 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 That's much better. This is just putting energy into what you're doing, making it fun. So meditation is fun, and religion is fun, and virtue is fun. And it doesn't cost anything to put a bit of fun into what you do. And that actually really makes the meditation take off. Okay. So the night is still young. Look, when you're in Singapore, what time do you go to bed at night? What time is it now? 9:20, it's early. But never mind, no, it's still the beginning of the day. If you want to go to bed now, please have a nice rest. If you want to sort of stay up later on, late, please stay up late. If you want to get up early, get up early, get up late, get up late. If you're really, really smart, ask the person next to you to practice compassion and bring you breakfast in bed. You never know your luck. So have a nice evening and I'll see you tomorrow morning.